My name is Kim Mutterson. I am the co-dean of Rutgers Law School in Camden, and this is The Power of Attorney. So I get to interview so many interesting people as a part of this podcast, and today is no different. Today I get to talk to our alum, Roger Clark, not to be confused with our former professor, Roger Clark, about his eclectic career, his time as an adjunct with us at the law school, and just all manner of fun things. So thanks so much for being here, Roger. It's great to see you as always.
Kim, thank you. It's a lot of fun to be here. Thanks for asking.
Absolutely.
Well, I do just want to say one thing before we get started. I don't have any problem whatsoever being confused with Roger S. Clark, being confused with someone who has been nominated for Nobel Peace Prize is just fine with me. But I can't claim to be that Roger Clark, yeah. Although I've known Roger I've known Roger since 1975. He taught me torque. He was one of my first professors at Rutgers Law School.
I love that. Especially because I don't think of Roger as a torts person, right? Because he's been a crim person for all the time that I've been at Rutgers. So it's funny for me to think about him teaching another.
Well, I think after he taught torts to my class, he threw up his hands and said, never again.
Seems possible, definitely. So the way I always start this podcast is by asking my guests to share their origin story with us. You know, of all the things that you could have chosen to do with your life, you decided that you wanted to go to law school and become a lawyer. So can you take us through that journey a little bit? What made you decide that law was where you wanted to be?
That's a wonderful question. And it probably is a difficult answer to truly answer because it compels anyone who's asked that question to really go deep and to understand their origins. And you know, as I reflect back on it, I realize that my original intent coming out of high school was to be a pilot for the United States Air Force. My father was a World War II pilot, ended up staying in the Air Force. He actually got out, but got recalled for Korea and then ended up staying. So I grew up on Air Force bases around the country and also overseas. I was around airplanes. I admired my father very much. And so I wanted to follow in his footsteps. And I actually went to the Air Force Academy. So I was at the Air Force Academy. As I was there, my eyes deteriorated. So I couldn't fly for the Air Force. Eyes tend to cross when they get tired. I have a color blindness as well. And I probably wasn't fit to be a career Air Force officer by temperament anyway. So maybe my eye issue gave me an excuse. So I transferred and went to Florida State University to complete the last year and a half, 2 years to complete my undergraduate education. And I suppose in a certain way, I was probably drifting a little bit about what I wanted to do. But I think I was probably deceiving myself because I think I probably knew what I wanted to do. But the direct trigger, once I recognized the direct career path I wanted to take, is that I took a business law class. And I was impressed with my professor. I seriously began to think about going to law school at that point. But that's the superficial story. I think much deeper. My interest and love for the law comes from my mother. As I have thought about this, I realized that she had dreams, I think, for me to be a lawyer. And that was always in the back of my mind at some point. So when I was in my final few months of undergrad, I decided and got serious about going to law school. And I was attracted to Rutgers. Rutgers had a good reputation even then. I was a little bit of a wanderlust because, as I mentioned, we lived all over the country and also overseas, but I'd never lived in the Northeast. Mm. So I was attracted to Rutgers for a couple of reasons. One, because of its reputation, and also because it was in the Northeast. Mm-hmm. To my surprise, I was accepted, and I hopped in the car and drove north from Florida to New Jersey.
Wow. So as somebody who, you know, sometimes we talk to people who have lawyers and judges in their family and, have folks to talk to about what is that law school experience going to be like. As somebody who didn't necessarily have access to that kind of information, what were you expecting when you got to law school, and did law school live up to your expectations?
Well, now I'm old enough to have remembered when this old movie Paper Chase came out.
Yes.
and it came out just, I think, a year or two before I applied to law school. So as I drove into town, I was expecting to see a Professor Kingsfield. Right? And we all had our Professor Kingsfields. So I was anticipating a intellectually and challenging environment. I was anticipating the Socratic method. Mm-hmm. So I was expecting something that would push me. And I wasn't disappointed. As I said, I expected to get an excellent education when I came to Rutgers. But I think a certain part of me took it for granted. I didn't realize as a student how spectacular my education was, you know, at the school. I don't mean to besmirch anybody, but I consider my Professor Kingsfield to be my Professor Kepner, who taught civil procedure my first year. And we were fortunate that he only called on you one time. But you had to brief a case when he called on you. And my very first lesson as a budding law student, which I've always held close ever since, was on the very first day of class in Professor Kepner's civil procedure class, because there must have been 180 people in the classroom. And Professor Kepner comes in striding up the center aisle, walks up to the dais, turns around, not saying a word, and opens up a notebook, you know, on the podium, and then takes his finger, puts it down, and calls out a name, which was not my name, which I'm glad. Anyway, it was someone in the far back, very back row, meekly said yes. And Professor Kepner said, give us your brief on Pumnoyer versus Neff, whatever it was. And so the student said, we had an assignment for today. And this is all pre-internet, pre-everything. We were shortly, it was after we'd learned how to write as a species, but it was before everything else. So the student said, I didn't know we were going to have an assignment. It was the first day of class. I thought this would be orientation session. And of course, that was what Professor Kepner was expecting. And then he pointed out that the worst mistake that any lawyer can make is to make assumptions. He said, you would assume there was no assignment. But the assignment has been out on the hallway since June 30, and it was there for anybody to read and see. So my very first lesson was, as a lawyer, you don't make assumptions. You have to drill down and find out what the actual facts are. Now, after that, the fear of God had been struck into me for that class. And I every day I completely briefed every class. I put more time into that class than any other in the first semester. He never called on me until finally, you know, the three or four days before exam, I was one of three or four people that had been called. I got to get ready for exams. And so I went out to the bookstore next door and bought a canned brief. I can make this. The statute of limitations is run on this now. So I read it. But so I bought a canned brief, and sure enough, you know, you wash your car, it rains the next day. Yeah. So my very first canned brief, the next day I go in, he calls on me. And so I've got my canned brief stuck in a notebook. So we have to stand up, and he's on the dais, and I'm just underneath him. I had to almost lean over backwards, almost breaking my back to hide the fact that I had a canned brief. Anyway, I read the canned brief. He asked me one question, I think. It asked for either a yes or no answer. I think I said yes. He says, well, that's not correct. No is the right answer, but good analysis. And I got to sit down. And then one of my very good friends, we're still good friends even now, Chris Lease, who has practiced with White & Williams as managing partner there until very recently, turned around, who was right in front of me, looked at me, and I can't quite repeat exactly what he said, but you lucky bah, 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 and then turned around.
So, I love everything about that story. It's a life lesson and a professional lesson, right? Don't make assumptions. It is a reminder. I think that this is, I say this to students all the time, that, you know, people will remember you in law school. They'll remember, you know, when you get called on, they'll remember all sorts of things about you. And so you really want to, you're building your reputation, you know, as soon as you start. And I love that you shared a story from your first day of law school, right? You will remember those moments. So make sure that you're ready and that you're prepared. And then also that a lot of us make lifelong friends in law school, right? That it doesn't have to be this sort of, you know, 3-year slog of pain and fear, that you actually can meet some really, really wonderful people, particularly at Rutgers, I think. So that's awesome. So once you made it through law school, what did you think that you wanted to do with your law degree?
This is where my interest in aviation, was still with me. I didn't have any direct path to an aviation practice coming out of law school. And my parents lived in Florida. They lived up in the northwest part of the state, up in the Panhandle. But I became afflicted with the tropical climate syndrome when I was a teenager. What I mean by that is that we lived in the Western Pacific on the tropical island of Guam for 2.5 years when I was, from 9th grade through the completion of my 11th grade in high school. And I noticed that it was kind of neat when the temperature never drops below 70 and never goes above 88. And the only way you have a white Christmas is to go down to the beach, which I did do once or twice, you know, in Christmas. So I kind of had this in the back of my mind, and so I hopped in the car and I drove south. This is kind of an apocryphal version of this, but anyway, what I'm trying to say is that I interviewed for jobs in Miami, and so took the Florida bar, became a Florida lawyer, and practiced in Miami for a few years. Nothing in aviation, however, doing a lot of other very interesting stuff. I just loved the folks I worked with. I was in two different firms there. One was back in those days, it was the largest firm in Florida. It tells you how much things have changed. It had 77 lawyers in it. It was the biggest firm in Florida in those days. That's now probably considered a boutique. And then I went over and joined a small plaintiffs firm. And I enjoyed plaintiff's work very much doing that, but wasn't in aviation. And then through my father, I had an opportunity to come out and interview with a firm in Los Angeles that did specialize in aviation. Remember, I could not qualify as a professional pilot, but I was able to qualify and get my private pilot's license from the Federal Aviation Administration. It has so many limitations on it. I probably need a lawyer to tell me when I can fly and can't fly. I can't fly at night by myself because of my color blindness and things like that. But I proved I could do it. So got my license and flew and enough to know about aviation and understand, the difference between a flap and an aileron kind of thing. But the folks in Los Angeles is a firm that specialized in aviation, made me an offer, and I came out to Los Angeles. And that was early 80s, 83, when I came out. And then opened up my eyes to how interesting aviation can be. I like to say aviation is a national practice, but it's a small town practice all combined. And what I mean by that is because it is a niche kind of practice. The people who over the years have practice exactly what I do, and we're heavy into aircraft crash litigation, insurance coverage, aviation matters, things of that nature, is relatively limited, maybe 400 or 500 people, and a lot of other branches of aviation, but precisely in what I do, it's probably 400 or 500 people nationally. So we'd get a call on a case, and it could be in Iowa, it could be in New York City, Georgia, Oregon, pick your state. And so we're having kind of a, we have to cross state lines, get admitted, you know, for the purpose of the case, walk into the courtroom. And this is where the small town practice component of it comes into. So you walk into a courtroom in Portland, Oregon for the first time, and you walk in on the case and you see the other lawyers there, and you know them all because they're from Georgia or they're from New York or they're from Philadelphia, or you know, and so that's the small town nature of the practice. And it's just been a thrill. To me, aviation is very challenging, very complex. It's in a substantive area that I just find fascinating. And yet it's had both a national and actually international component too. I kind of should have mentioned I've had cases, you know, outside of the United States, but you make good friends, and you come across people. One of the nice things about the aviation practice, because you come across people time and time again, and you know them, you tend to have a tendency to be old school, in the sense that you call someone up and you need an agreement on something and an extension, and the other person will say, fine, you know, send me a note just to confirm it. And you have a really high assumption that oral agreement will be honored in actual practice. Well, one of the things a lot of lawyers these days lament, I think, with big city practices, in a town like Los Angeles, where I am now, where there's just so many lawyers and so many judges, that you can go through a 40-50 year career and never come across the same lawyer or even the same judge, you know, again. So having that small town component of an aviation practice has been very attractive to me, and I've enjoyed that very much.
Yeah. There are so many pieces there that I want to delve into a little bit. Let's go back and then come forward. So you said when you got out of law school that you were a plaintiff's lawyer. And I think a lot of times people hear that and they have no idea what it means when somebody says, hey, I'm a plaintiff's lawyer. So can you first sort of walk through that a little bit? And then we'll talk about aviation, which I think is fascinating.
Well, as a plaintiff's lawyer, you represent the claimant someone who has suffered some kind of loss or injury, whether it's a bodily injury, a loss of a family member through a death, or if it's a financial loss through a breach of contract or some kind of business infraction, and someone has suffered because of that way. The only thing that the law can't replace lives, obviously, can't restore a leg, and can't undo post-traumatic stress disorder. So the only thing the courts can do is to try to come up with some type of financial compensation for those kinds of injuries. So a plaintiff's lawyer represents those individuals who have suffered some kind of harm and bring a case to court on their behalf pursue that case in the courtroom, working it up ultimately for trial if it gets that far. And along the steps to get that far, you first have to file something called a complaint, which is on behalf of the plaintiff. Then you have to serve that complaint on the people that you accuse of being at fault for what happened, and they have an opportunity to answer it, and there's an answer on file. Then once the answer is on file, you have what's called an at-issue case. So we know what the issues are. Then you have to develop the facts, the evidence that explores those issues, and you enter a phase that's called discovery, which can mean taking depositions, actually sit down witnesses somewhere and with a court reporter, and you swear them as if they're actually in a trial, and ask questions, and there's cross-examination, much as if you would actually be in a courtroom. And so you learn your case, you exchange documents, you exchange sworn statements back and forth, items called interrogatories, which have statements under oath about what the positions and the facts are as known by the other side, and you learn your case. And you come up, you have a trial date, and you go to and actually try the case in front of a jury, mostly. Plaintiff's lawyers like to have juries as opposed to having judges try their case, although some plaintiff's lawyers will actually take issue with that in some instances, because I think statistically it shows that the judges are just as favorable as juries are in some cases, maybe not all cases. But that's the bias anyway, is to try a case to a jury.
Yeah. So, you know, being a plaintiff's lawyer is, you know, really different from lots of other practices of law in that you're working with people who have experienced deep loss or trauma or some sort of, you know, catastrophic accident. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what it's like to be, and I think this is an aspect of lawyering that folks don't always think about. You're not just, you know, asking people questions and trying to figure out, you know, what the damages are. You're also working with somebody who, you know, is maybe in pain or, you know, is mourning. And how do you manage that relationship with somebody, which is a professional relationship because you're their lawyer, but they're also someone who's telling you, you know, really painful things that have happened to them?
Yeah. There is often a good deal of armchair therapy associated with it. The most important thing is to listen and to empathize. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that, you know, every loss is different. Even though the lawyer who's sitting behind the desk may have lost someone important to them, it gives them some rough idea of what their client may be suffering. But every loss is unique. And to sit and listen and try to understand and get some basic grasp of emotionally what they're going through. And that's a challenge. But you have to listen, and you have to let, the person who suffered the loss tell their story, and give them time to do it. And sometimes the story doesn't come out all at once. Sometimes it may take months, if not a year or so. A lot of times, things happen at a deposition, that you may have sat down with your client and talked about the loss, and you think you understand and have been told everything there is to be told. Then you're at a deposition, and then because of the pressure of the moment, the person will come out with something that surprises you. And that even happens beyond the deposition, but in courtroom, because just of the pressure of the circumstances, it has a tendency to actually bring things to the surface that a lot of people will keep buried.
Absolutely. And, you know, I want to ask one more question about plaintiff's lawyers, because, as I said, you know, I teach torts. And so, you know, I think a lot about our system of, you know, how we deal with accidents and bad things that happen to people. But I think sometimes plaintiff's lawyers get a really bad rap, right? That the sort of, you know, conversation is about people who are just chasing money and, you know, they're not the kind of lawyers that we should like. So, which I totally disagree with. But so I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about, you know, how important the plaintiff's bar is, right? And the work that folks do, not only for individuals, but the impact that work can have much more broadly.
Yeah. Yeah, I have the highest respect for plaintiff's lawyers. And, you know, we all know that no profession is perfect. There's going to be some bad actors in every profession. But my experience is that by far and away, the vast majority of plaintiff's lawyers are empathetic to their clients, are trying to achieve justice for their clients, and do the best that they can on behalf of them. And some of the most generous people you'd ever want to find are plaintiff's lawyers. They're committed to justice. I think deep down they feel that they're on a mission trying to make the world a better place. And you look back over the last 40 or 50, 60 years, 70 years, all the post-World War II years, I think that the plaintiff's bar has had a huge impact on our culture in terms of defining what is safe, what's mm-hmm. acceptable. We're far safer now. You look at tobacco, for example, just as one example, and what the plaintiff's bar has meant to smoking mm-hmm. and reducing the exposure to carcinogens. And that's thanks to the plaintiff's bar. A group of people that were willing to put their lives and their money and years of effort into carrying this fight on. So, they're not just Don Quixote. They're not mm-hmm. The plaintiff's lawyers aren't just Don Quixote. They're fighting a real legitimate fight on behalf of justice for people who otherwise would not have it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of times people don't think about, particularly people who are not lawyers, who are not a part of the legal system, don't think about the ways in which lawsuits are their own form of regulation, right? I mean, it's sort of saying to people, this industry standard is problematic. You need to change it. And that can be really, as you say, very, very broad in terms of its impact. So maybe we should be a little nicer to plaintiffs' lawyers than we are.
I'll throw my vote in for that. Yes.
Perfect. So let's talk about aviation. So first of all, it's such a great thing to be somebody who can combine your professional life with something that's incredibly interesting and important to you in your personal life. So I think that's really fun. But also, you know, I think aviation law is also this space where if you throw that out, people aren't quite sure what it means and what are all the different ways in which you might have to practice if you have an aviation law practice. So can you walk us through that a little bit? I mean, obviously, it's when planes crash, obviously, sure. There, you know, we all hear about the litigation there. But what are some of the other things that happen in an aviation law practice?
Oh, sure. Well, there's just so much. And, you know, you look at, aviation, it's the nice thing about the subject matter of aviation is that it cross-pollinates a broad field. And when you look at civil procedure issues, aviation typically, you look in the case books, and typically the most complex civil procedure cases you read about are aviation cases. The interplay between federal and state rights, the trigger word there is to a large extent is preemption, because the U.S. Constitution has a supremacy clause, so laws passed by Congress are supposed to be supreme. They'll trump, so to speak, you know, any countervailing state laws, and that's a preemption analysis. So there's a lot of you might look at aviation as kind of like a course in geology. There's a lot of tectonic plate shifts, so you have a tremendous amount of tension between state and federal rights in aviation. Constantly, there's fights over if there is a remedy. Is it provided by federal or is it provided by state law? Or if it's provided by state law, does a federal law take it away or limit it or increase it? Those types of things. So many of the cases can be in, you know, federal court or state court. There's this whole process about removal that most plaintiff's lawyers, when it comes to an aviation case, would prefer to be in state court. There's one or two exceptions where I think plaintiff's lawyers believe that, federal court might be more favorable forum for them. But for the most part, plaintiff's lawyers prefer to be in a state forum on the assumption that ultimately the awards are more often given to the plaintiffs in a state environment, and then the awards themselves are a little bit higher. That's the bias anyway. But on to contrary to that, the defense lawyers want to be in federal court as much as they can. So there's this process. If there's potentially a federal jurisdiction, the defense lawyers will look at a case and will remove it from state court to federal court. And then you get into a fight over whether or not the case should be remanded back to state court or not. And those have always been some very, interesting battles. When you look at, just give you an example one case, how complex it can be. There was a crash of a six engine or six person aircraft outside of Sydney, Australia. They were actually on a search and rescue mission to look for some friends who had disappeared flying another airplane west of Sydney the day before. This aircraft that was on a search and rescue suffered an engine failure and had to go into the mountains and ended up, unfortunately, four of the six people on board died from the crash, and the two people in the back survived but were, seriously harmed. And they called me in Los Angeles because the airplane was made in the United States and the engine was made in Mobile, Alabama. We filed several suits because we weren't sure which court would retain the case. So I filed a lawsuit in Los Angeles, where one of the defendants was located, but then also filed it in Alabama, Mobile, Alabama, where one of the other defendants was located, and became associated with a law firm that since some of the lawyers there became some of my best friends and still are even to this day. But we ended up deciding to go forward, and the court in Mobile, Alabama kept the case. And we move forward. We spent several months in Australia taking depositions, and you know, it's a different process down there. You have to get permission from the court to do it. You just can't notice them, and you have to be supervised by a judge while you're taking the depositions. And and we had the depositions didn't go on just for 2 months; they were double tracked. We were we probably had 3 months of testimony. Then our judge and state court in Mobile told us we had 2 weeks to try the case, and we all kind of fell off our chairs, had clutching our chest, having a heart attack. So how are we going to get 6 weeks or 2 months of testimony down to 2 weeks? But there's a thing called choice of law in these cases, and it's unusual in an aviation case for there not to be a choice of law issue. You know, these airplanes have a tendency to leave the ground; they go to other places, mm-hmm. and so you might have multiple states involved, and you're not sure where the lawsuit is going to be filed. So you have to decide, well, what law is going to apply? Now, it could be a state of California, state of Florida, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, or federal law versus state law. Or in this particular case that I'm talking about, this accident occurred in New South Wales. Now, Alabama at this time had this choice of law rule. It's called lex loci, which means you apply the law of the place of where the accident happened. So the accident happened in New South Wales, Australia. That meant Alabama was going to apply the law of New South Wales. So how does the court in Alabama know what the law of New South Wales was? So we actually had a trial just on choice of law. And we brought all these retired judges and barristers, you know, from the Queen's Bench up from Sydney. And so we had a full day of testimony about what the law was. But I laugh about this because it's a, you know, clash of cultures, because I noticed that as the day was wearing on, because every now and then I look behind my shoulder, people would be coming, entering the courtroom. And I noticed that the Australians, every time they were coming in, they were bowing. Hmm. And every time they were leaving, they'd turn around and they'd bow before they leave. And so finally we had a break. I said, what are you guys doing? I says, well, we're paying our respects to the court. I said, guys, these are the colonies, okay? I said, we don't do that. You know, we don't even wear wigs. You know, the lawyers don't wear robes. And you have to realize our judge, you know, and we'd been down in, in one of the courtrooms in Sydney, and it's full of pageantry and the flowing robes and the wigs and the scarlet robes and the big staffs and the tonations, you know, and all this sort of stuff. And it's all very solemn and impressive. And by contrast, our judge in Alabama, that no one would announce his entrance. The door would just open from the side and he'd come in, his robe would be open at the front. He had a coffee cup. He'd walk up, sit down, put a foot on the bench and say, what's on the docket today, boys? All right. It was an interesting culture contrast, but we all spoke English for the most part. and we all shared a common heritage, of the common law, with a lot of variations on it. But we spent the whole day just trying the law, and we ultimately held a mediation on that case. But the mediation was held in Los Angeles, and so we successfully settled the case, which meant that we never had to answer the question of how do we get 2 months of testimony into a 2 week trial. So I'm glad we never had to test that.
So an accident in Australia, a lawsuit filed in Alabama, right, and then a mediation in California.
That's right. Yeah.
All in one case. Yeah. So I feel like after we're done today, I'm going to have to reach out to all my civil procedure colleagues and say, you can have your students listen to the Roger Clark podcast, and then they'll know how important civil procedure is, right? I mean, that's a class I think in the first year that students often struggle with because it's not intuitive. It's just sort of this bunch of rules, and yet civil procedure is where it's at. I mean, it makes or breaks a case in so many ways.
Having, like I said, grown up, on military bases, I was taught by my father, who was a career Air Force pilot, that the word is mightier than the sword. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a time component to that. I mean, humorously, because if I have a book in my hand, I'm facing somebody with a sword in their hand, I'm not going to put my money on the guy with the book. But I get the point. Because those folks who have served in the military protect us, so that those of us who live by the word can implement the word. And civil procedure is at the core of that. And some of the most thrilling moments I've had in my career is walking into a courtroom where the issue is, do we have jurisdiction over someone 12,000 miles away on something that happened in a foreign country? And dealing with the issues, can this court here in Los Angeles rightfully assert jurisdiction over that person, can proceed with the case, and make a determination under the law and the facts as to whether an award is appropriate or not, and then can it be enforced? It's a thrilling thing to me to see justice in that way work. As I said, it's just some of the most thrilling moments in my career to see how that can happen, and civil procedures at the core of that.
Yep, absolutely. So one of the ways that I think I first met you was when I was vice dean and you were teaching and have been teaching for us as an adjunct at the law school for many, many years. And I think that the initial story that I heard was, oh, we have this adjunct who flies himself here to teach for our students, to teach aviation law for our students. And I thought, this is a man I want to meet. That sounds really fascinating. But I do want to talk about the aviation law course, because over the last several years, I know that you've sort of turned it into this, you know, more skills-based course where you're sort of having the students work through a case. Can you describe that a little bit? Because I think it just seems like so much fun.
Yeah. You know, and I have fun teaching it. The last couple of years, I based the course on the real life 737, the Boeing 737 MAX litigation, primarily the crash in Ethiopia. And those lawsuits out of that crash were filed in federal court in the Northern District of Illinois. Now, you know, people may say, well, this is a crash in Ethiopia. Why are lawsuits being filed in Chicago? And the reason they're filed in Chicago is because that's where Boeing is headquartered. So there's jurisdiction, you know, over Boeing. And there can be arguments after as well about whether or not the court should keep the cases, because there may be a more appropriate place for them to be tried and that kind of thing. But I based the course on that real life incident, and then a generous wrinkling of hypothetical facts, you know, to change the issues and change the arguments that we're making. We'll typically this year we met, I think, every 2 weeks for, you know, 2 week session. We actually met on the weekends, which is really nice because there's no other distractions and a lot of folks that may have a hard time making a, you know, nighttime class on a Tuesday or Wednesday night, or daytime class, do have the time on Saturday and Sunday. And I really appreciate the fact that they gave up their football time. You know, they could be watching the Eagles, you know, and they're with me instead.
Watching the Eagles lose. Yeah.
Well, spring's eternal. what we did, you know, we'll have different subject matters. And, you know, if you had a pie chart, you know, the question is, what is aviation law? And a lot of things get slung into that pie chart. You know, there's international law. This is coming back to Roger S. Clark that we were talking about earlier. You know, you take the Ethiopian air disaster. It was a flight from one country to another, and that triggers the international law component of aviation, which is called the Montreal Treaty, which has all sorts of different issues associated with it. So we study international law. You know, how do you interpret a treaty? You know, and what sources do you have to interpret that treaty, and then how do you implement the treaty? So we're dealing with that, and because we're coming back to civil procedure, you know, you have hundreds of people, hundreds of different claims. It is all very complex, you know, civil procedure processes that come into play when you have a mass tort lawsuit like that, multiple people. So it's most of these complex civil procedure processes have been developed because of the aviation matters over the years. You know, and so you have to manage the cases. Then you have the interplay between what happened in the government and You have administrative law, because a lot of these matters can work their way up through the administrative agencies before they get to the court. And you have issues of what kind of deference the courts need to give, if any, you know, to the federal agencies and how they interpret their laws and the rules and the regulations and things of that nature. And then, as I said earlier, you know, you look at this tension between, well, we have this case in Ethiopia, the crash in Ethiopia, but you have people from all over the world that were on that airplane. So you have this, you know, poor judge in Chicago said, well, what, first of all, what's law and liability? You know, so I got to figure out what is the law to be applied to determine if there's fault here. But then after that, what are the laws on damages? I mean, should someone from Kenya, you know, have the same law on damages applied to that person's case as, say, someone from the state of New York? So you have a choice of law on damages. So you can have multiple choice of law issues arising in the same case. So in this course, you know, we teach these different subject matters, but then we would they would have assignments. And so typically the 2-day sequence, we'd study the substance day one, half of the day two. But then they would have assignments where they'd have to argue different motions. Everybody's a lawyer in my classroom. There's no law. Everybody's a lawyer. So they get up and they argue for proposition or a motion and in opposition to it. And we did that. And as we went on and we went on, we first did it as a group. We had 3 or 4 people on a team just so everybody could get their feet wet. And then the team would get reduced to 2. And by the time at the very end, it was a single lawyer arguing a single motion, and someone as a single individual would be in opposition to that. And we would go into the, you know, Rutgers has a beautiful moot courtroom, you know, real court houses, many real court houses across the country would die for this moot courtroom. but we go in on the final day, and we spend the full final day arguing. This is where the rubber meets the road, because now everybody has their feet wet. They understand how the process is. So everybody is writing, submitting their papers in advance, exchanging their papers, just like you would in a real court practice. And they come ready for bear, right? And they're ready to argue. Every year I'm just so impressed with the quality of the arguments, and they're just so much talent. This year was just no different, and folks were making arguments and coming up with issues that I just found thrilling, things that I hadn't thought. I always learn from this. Mm-hmm. I almost feel like I'm cheating because I'm supposed to be the professor, but actually I'm learning, you know, but I learn from my students. And we went through this whole process, and we wear the robes. So I sit there in the robe. So they have the experience of being in a courtroom environment with a judge, and they get challenged. There's no free pass on this. So just like a real lawyer, you know, if the real lawyer is going to go off on some kind of tangent, you know, they're going to be challenged. And what's your basis to make that claim? Is that the law? Is that the fact? And so they get pressed on it, just like you would in real life. And then I have the students cycle up, because I like them to put the robe on for at least one cycle to sit with me, because what a difference a point of view makes. So suddenly you're looking at it from the perspective of the judge, and what that means for them. The next time they argue, they'll have the experience of what you know, courtroom looks like from the perspective of the person sitting on the bench, and that may affect and improve the quality of their argument the next time around. So we have a lot of fun doing it, and I think that the idea is that by the time the course is over, the students understand what it means to argue, and you know, we all, lawyers are famous for talking, but the reality is that 90% of our time is writing, you know, not talking. And so it's important to focus and make the impression that it's important to write well, and write well. And then once you actually get into the courtroom, you know, speak well also. So and that's part of the process of trying to learn these skills. And it's not just being in the courtroom as a lawyer. These are things that serve you in life everywhere. You know, so the next community event you go to, you want to, you know, lawyers are expected to be leaders. And so, I mean, it's by virtue of having that law degree. People look to, I know so-and-so who lives down the block. They're a lawyer. I think they should take the lead at the next community meeting. And they expect you to get up and make the presentation. So these are skills that apply all across the board, whether it's in the community center or whether it's in the boardroom or office or the courtroom.
And the classes that are taught by our adjuncts, you know, particularly the skills classes, I think those are some of the classes, along with the clinics, that students tend to love the most, right? Because it really lets you, you know, try on what it means to be a lawyer and all of these sort of different facets. And it's a really nice way for people to start to feel, to start to build their professional identity, which I think is really terrific. But the other thing that I want to talk about, because I know that I've taken a lot of your time, I don't want to take all day, but I do want to talk about mediation, because on one hand, you know, trials are really exciting and the idea of standing up in front of the judge and, you know, pitching to the jury and all of this good stuff. But a lot of cases don't go to trial, right? And the idea of having alternative ways, you know, ADR, alternative dispute resolution, is certainly a lot more popular now than it was in the past. And you have a mediation practice. Yes. So could you talk about, certainly as somebody who's had both experiences, you know, how is mediation different, and why, if you believe this to be true, why is mediation really such a critical part of our legal system now?
The cases of I've been practicing since 78, and so when I started practicing, mediation was not the name of the game. And in fact, I think that the first court implemented mediation program was in the Pacific Northwest, Oregon or Washington, about that time. And so mediation started to creep into the parlance generally, you know, in the 80s. And most lawyers were suspicious of it. And because you don't want to go to a mediation and spill the beans, because I've got that ace, you know, in my pocket. I don't want them to know about that ace in my pocket. I'm keeping that for trial. And you know, of course, these are people who've been, you know, we're talking about 1980. These are people who've been practicing law since World War II. So it was a trial mindset. Now, and if you go back historically, you go back to Abraham Lincoln. I think that the standard rule is that 9 out of 10 cases that were filed, and we're talking about civil cases, that were filed in the days of the 1830s and 1840s and 1850s, 80 or 90% of those would go to trial. And then I think by 1930s or so, that number was down to about 50%. When I started practicing in the late 70s, the general rule was 1 out of 10 goes to trial. Now it's less. It may be something like 1 out of 100. And part of what's going on is that the cases generally have become more fact-intensive, paper-intensive. It's harder to get these cases tried, because you go back 40 years ago, you'd see one of the old war horses, you know, go down and try a case, had a folder that was, that was barely, a few millimeters thick, and said, I got my 3 documents. That's all I need on this case. I got the 3 key documents, right? And a lot of lawyers would say any case can be boiled down to 3 documents, right? And I haven't heard anybody say that in a few years, but the point is that it's gotten a lot more paper intensive, a lot more fact intensive, and the judges are pressed for time, because their caseload has increased. I think the number of judges per capita has not increased with what it was maybe 40, 50 years ago. That's my impression. It's not anything I've read recently, but yet, so the caseloads on the courts have gone up. They don't have as much time to spend on cases. So the courts now rely heavily on the mediation process to get the cases resolved. What I've noticed is that there's some lawyers who now traditionally trial lawyers, but also have become very good mediator lawyers, are good at mediation, because the mindset now is where you'd once prepare a case for trial and a mediation was a distraction in advance of that, where now people generally prepare a case for mediation. And if it doesn't get resolved, then they do go on to trial. So it is a different mindset. And people will come with mediation. And now the bias in mediation, and now I'm speaking as a mediator, I said, if you want a case settled, share everything with me. And you don't hold that ace in your pocket. And so when you look at a matter, it's a mixed, mediation is a mixed motive process. Generally, both sides want to settle, but yet they can't agree on a number. So there's a mutual desire to settle. There's distance on where the number is. And the mediator's job is to try to, of course, get the parties together to a point where both parties probably want to go, but neither wants to be the first to get there. So I've been doing this long enough now, I understand the strengths and weaknesses in cases. And so this is by virtue of my experience as a practicing trialer comes into mediation, particularly in aviation cases and things like that. Where I can understand where the strengths and weaknesses are of someone's case, and help them work through that, and help them to appraise the case and evaluate it, and help to get them to a place where the case can settle. Because typically, both sides start on the somebody's going to be probably outrageously high, and someone's going to be outrageously low, and you need to get to both of them within what's called a zone of reasonableness. And once you get both sides within a zone of reasonableness, kind of it becomes gravitational. The parties have a tendency to come together. But they just, as I said, neither wants to be the first one to get there. So part of the mediator's job is to help them get there at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I enjoy mediation. It's a challenge. There's a lot of satisfaction for me to sit down on a complex case with a lot of challenges to it and help the parties work through their problems. And to get a resolution, and sometimes I have to remind myself I'm not an advocate, because I've got a mediation coming up at the very beginning next week on an interesting matter. But I look at when I read the briefs, I'll read one brief and I realize I'm thinking as an advocate, as if I wrote that brief, and I said, wait a second, just cool down here. Now that I read the other brief and then I flip up the other side, and then I need to get in the right mindset. Because I'm not an advocate, I'm a facilitator that is there to try to help the parties, to resolve the case. Get the case resolved. I mediate for the federal court, and have done that for a number of years now. That's whenever we run across and talk to the judges, they're always happy to see us because they give us a pat in the back and say, we want you guys to settle these cases. So
get them off my docket.
They're just busy. They're just busy.
Yeah. Well, Roger, thank you so much. I mean, this was just an absolute pleasure. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, but it's great to just sort of hear your journey and hear your perspective as somebody who's been practicing law for a really long time and who has sort of watched some of the shifts that have happened in our legal system, hopefully mostly for good. So thank you again. Thank you so much for your time. And I look forward to when we can, grab dinner again.
Thank you, Kim. It's been a pleasure. And I will always enjoy talking to you. And kudos to you and all the faculty and staff at Rutgers Law School. It's a wonderful place. Can't say enough about it. And, I not only did I make great friends, but I learned how to think and got a tremendous education, and the return on my investment at Rutgers is just off the charts. I doubt that Bill Gates has had a better return on investment than what I got from my education at Rutgers. So thanks for all that you guys do.
The Power of Attorney is produced by Rutgers Law School. With two locations, minutes from Philadelphia and New York City, Rutgers Law offers the prestige and reputation of a large, nationally known university with a personal small campus experience. Learn more by visiting law.rutgers.edu.